Philosophy. Descartes. Debate. The Mep Report. Mep Report. Mep Report. The awesomest discussion podcast in the history of the human species.
Oh, yeah!
Let me tell you of an interview with an old man emu. He's got a beak and feathers and things, but the poor old fella ain't got no wings. Aren't you jealous of the wedge-tailed eagle? Well, the eagle's flying round and round to keep my 2 feet firmly on the ground. Now, I can't fly, but I'm telling you, I could run the pants off a kangaroo. But he can't fly, but I'm telling you, he can run the pants off a kangaroo.
In that case, welcome to Mep Report number 161. It is December 30th, 2019.
Woo,
the last Mep Report of the decade. Wow. It's the last Mep Report of the decade, guys. So
unless you ask Zimmy, and Zimmy will send you an angry email that says, it's not the end of the decade because the 20s include 2019, or no, the opposite.
I was going to say, wait, what?
Because what?
The 20s include 2030. Sorry, the 20s include all of 2030.
Well, that's fine. I'm happy to have that argument with him when we get to 2029. But like, saying
the teens this decade, according to Zimmy and some other pedantic people, includes the year to come. I disagree with this. I think it's ridiculous.
Yes, yes.
But yeah.
Yes, there was this argument during the millennium switchover too.
Yes, exactly. They're like, it doesn't start until 2001.
Which, by the way, and first of all, welcome to all our listeners. We hope everybody's doing well. We do wish you a happy 2020 to come, and we wish you a happy new year and happy holidays and all that. But I do have to say, I was reading this thing about the whole, it reminded me of the whole Y2K thing. And how a lot of people were like, you know, oh, listen, dude, that was such a dud. And they were so, and I was reading this stuff by people being like, the reason that it was a dud is because people freaked out and did something about it. Like, like it wasn't like, oh, that was silly. And they just sat there, twiddled their thumbs, and then the world did not blow up. Like the world did not blow up because people were like, let's keep the world from not blowing up. And this sort of gleeful sense of just like, ah, it's like Al Capone's vault. It's nothing. I just don't, you know, Y2K, man, stopped because people gave a damn about Y2K. So sometimes these things actually make a difference. But
and the Mayan apocalypse didn't happen in 2012 because we planned ahead, right? And we appeased Teotihuacan, and he was cool with us, and everything was good.
Yeah, that was kind of a rough one too.
We
because
just made enough calendars that.
More right, calendars.
Like there's so many more calendars than the Mayan calendar, it became irrelevant.
We just did the shock and awe confusion method of like, try this one. He's like, what is this Gregorian calendar?
I love that the calendar theory of apocalypse is that whichever calendar has like a plurality among all calendars, and that apocalypse is the only one that can happen.
You know what's going to be great is when like the world ends on like June 3rd, like 2032, and they're like, this was actually, if you had counted correctly, the millennium. But like you all kept adding years and switching around and the Julian thing, and like if you had been counting correctly from the first, you would have known.
But the Four Horsemen were so disappointed to roll in on a June 3rd. They're like, what is this? Heather is wrong.
And they're frustrated by it too, right? Like they just sit there and just kind of like, oh man, like I love the idea too that as the world is coming to an end, there would be the people being like, you see, I showed you all along that this was actually how there will always be the pedants even during it'll be a pedantic apocalypse,
I think is
the way that all works.
We're living that right now.
It's a pedantic
regardless of the outcomes.
That's actually true. Whatever
everyone happens, is an armchair quarterback telling you how wrong you were about whatever you did.
It is true. And, you know, I was thinking about this with the Rise of Skywalker, have we all seen it?
We're already there.
Have we all seen it? No, I'm not. I wasn't.
Yeah, we've all seen it. We've all seen it. Yeah.
So here we go. I haven't gotten to a discussion. I don't even necessarily. I mean,
3 hours.
No. I'm happy to get into a discussion if you want. I wasn't even going to go there.
Can I just say, I feel like we talked about The Last Jedi like 2 Mep Reports ago. Like, it was not that long.
I recently re-listened to the whole thing because as the Rise of Skywalker was coming, people were re-quizzing me on like why I was so terrified of it, and I had to like remember all of my arguments of why The Last Jedi was the greatest fiction I've ever seen.
And this is the way that it happened. No, I wasn't even going to actually necessarily, I mean, I'm happy to talk about it if you want, but I wasn't even going to go there.
I mean, it's happening now. Now it's happening.
I only, put the thing back in the bottle. No, I only was going to bring it up because I was thinking about this, the idea, then this is not unique to me. Other people have talked about this, that the level of kind of vitriol, and I don't buy that this is just, well, we were polarized. Like in the 19th century, people were also extraordinarily polarized. Like this is not the only time in history people have radically disagreed on things. But I find it interesting that if you look at sort of news reports and things like that about the reception to Star Wars, Empire, and Return of the Jedi, there's just way, way less of this people going, getting ready to be pissed off at a thing that there is with these later movies. And I feel like some of this, you started to feel in Force Awakens, there was a lot of it that happened after Last Jedi. And Rise of Skywalker sort of, you know, continues that trend. I don't know whether it seems like The Mandalorian is something that a lot of people can agree with, that a lot of people seem to like, so I haven't felt as much vitriol with that. But I do wonder about that. Like, it just seems like there was a lot less, people were like, oh, sweet, I get to go see a Star Wars film. It just seems like there was a lot less vitriol at that time. And we're not talking about ancient history. This isn't, you know, in the 1910s, this is how people were. I mean, this is the 1980s. Even the prequels, it seems to me, which are what, 97, 8, 9, they weren't that vitriolic in comparison to what we got, you know, with these.
I don't think anything was more vitriolic than the prequels as far as Star Wars is
concerned. That may be true, especially
Jar
Jar.
The prequels really got, you know, and I think, if anything, I think that sort of helped generate this, you know, ongoing nature of it. But I think part of it is like the trend that, like, not to get all generational because that's a fraught exercise, but I think is most closely correlated to Generation X, of just kind of like, you can't like things that other people like because they like them, and popular,
it's too hip, yeah,
immediately, yeah, yeah. Uncool. Yep. It's not cool to like what other people like, and so you have to tear it down.
Exactly.
I don't think that's the whole story with it, but I think that has,
there is a little edgelordy quality to it almost. This is like the Death Cab for Cutie sucks because someone else likes them but me argument, right? Like at a certain point, exactly, everyone started to like it, and then it was all and I'm sorry, man,
I never experienced that because I got caught on to Death Cab for Cutie like 10 years after the fact, and I'm like, oh, this guys are good. I've never heard of them.
You got to be countercultural again, Russ. You were like, I actually like them. And everyone's like, oh, they suck.
Guys,
like,
have you heard this new band? Great.
Yeah. I'm always way behind on that stuff. So anything I discover, I just consider it a win and I move on.
I have to say, like, I really, you know, I felt that way a lot about Mass Effect, the Mass Effect games, especially Mass Effect 3, which got tons of hate because of its ending. And then they fixed the ending and did all this stuff. By the time I got to playing it, I was like, this is great. And everyone's like, oh, you should have been here 3 years ago when it sucked. I'm like, but I wasn't, so it doesn't suck now.
And that's my experience with No Man's Sky, which was like the most anticipated video game release of decades, and everyone hated it. It was buggy and glitchy and garbage. I started playing it 3 years in when they fixed everything and added a bunch of great stuff. And I was like, oh, this is great. I enjoy it. Thanks.
Yep. It's totally true. But it is sort of like, I wonder if that's a culture. I think you may be right about that story in part. And I wonder if there's also a cultural aspect of, I've always felt, I mean, I intensely dislike cynicism, as people who listen to the show will know. I don't like cynicism because I think it's an incredibly cheap and also an inaccurate dodge. This idea that if you go in believing that everything is going to suck, then that somehow keeps you from being worse hurt. I think all that means is that you just sort of emotionally speaking die by a thousand cuts. You know, you just basically bleed out instead of having one terrible thing apparently hurt you. So I think cynicism is a horrific dodge and is actually the most dangerous thing, is to give in to cynicism. But I wonder if, you know, maybe the sort of waiting around for something to dislike it. Like, you don't want to, Star Wars for a while almost felt like this thing that was so kind of universal, I shouldn't say universally, but so generally, I guess, loved, that people were like, ah, this is a place where I can, it's a goofy space opera. It's not anything like incredibly radical, but it does have good philosophical themes and there's good characters in it and da 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 da. And you could just feel good about it. And you almost, people didn't accept the cynicism of Star Wars for a while, being about cynical about Star Wars, because this is a place where I get to relax for a while and just enjoy something without having to immediately be, you know, edgelordy and check out how cynical and, you know, deep I am.
And yeah, if you want to be an edgelord, you can. Logan's Run can be your favorite sci-fi movie, and you can be one of that tiny group of people, which the movie has an interesting concept, and it's like very weirdly executed and runs too long, and they go visit Abraham Lincoln for some reason, and it's just like a bunch of things make no sense. But Star Wars was, I think, as universally loved as anything could possibly be. I mean, certainly people had criticisms of it, and like a lot of people didn't like Return of the Jedi, but... You know, the sound editing, the video effects were like the first of their kind invented for this movie. So it was, in many ways, you know, ahead of the pack in many categories.
And there was a kind of, you know, I don't want to say, I don't want to get too down in nostalgia about it, but I mean, there was a kind of sense of, purity is too strong, but there was a sense of hopefulness about it that wasn't just, it's all garbage and we're all, but, and that was because it was based.
Because it was based on old, like, Flash Gordon serials and just, like, very simple hero stories.
And married to Kurosawa and Seven Samurai and the hero's journey and stuff like that. So I think you're right about that. And by the way, this was all happening during a set of movies that were also always intensely commercial. You know, this idea that Disney took over and all of a sudden they became commercial is nonsense. If you walked into any toy store in the 1980s, you saw rows of Kenner Star Wars action figures and Millennium Falcon Lego things. And like, I mean, they were incredibly commercial. They sold everything they could sell from those movies. So it wasn't just then they became commercial and they sold out. It was that people sort of accepted them in a different way. And, you know, is that because we've grown up so much since the 80s? I don't know, maybe. But it feels to me like when you see examples here and there of sort of new things that come out, the immediate sort of run to be like, I knew it was going to be terrible. I knew this was going to suck. I knew it. I don't understand the joy that people seem to get from it, or maybe joy is not the right word, the satisfaction they get from being like, I was out front of this disappointment.
So I think a lot of that, jumped into it started with the prequels. It started with the prequels, that there was so much anticipation and buildup for the prequels. And at least the first one, and probably the first two, and maybe all three were like extraordinarily disappointing. I know we vary on that commentary, so I'm not going to speak for all of us, but that Star Wars fans felt a little bit abused by Lucasfilm. And so they felt like the only way to go into this thing that they love when they kept spinning out new versions of it was with this very cynical approach of like, well, I can't get excited about it because I've been burned too many times. And so that still persists for sure.
Because, and I wonder if this is a Star Wars thing more specifically, and maybe because I think, you know, people who heard us just talk about Last Jedi and other things will know that. So Russ is probably the biggest Star Wars fan of the three of us. I consider myself a pretty big Star Wars fan. Russ is the biggest, I think. I'm a pretty big Star Wars fan. Story, I would say, I don't want to speak for you, but I'd say you're less of one, right? Like, you like them okay, but they're not like your
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm a different kind of, you know... I think I'm a different kind of Star Wars fan. I mean, I have seen all of them, you know, within X days of their opening, whatever. I mean, before Guns took away midnight movies, I used to see them all at midnight. I mean, it's true, right?
Like, no, I know.
Man ended the midnight movie phenomenon in America. It's really sad. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, I guess that's fair. I guess I'm third just because, again, without making it too much of a generational thing, like, despite us all being very close in age, I identify as millennial and you guys identify as Generation X. And I think that makes a difference between, like, I think
we're on different sides of 1980.
Right. I mean,
ours is the better time.
It's like a matter of months.
We're children of the 70s.
Right. Very, very close. But I think there's a way in which no one outside of Generation X can be the fan of Star Wars that someone in Generation X is. I mean, if you like Star Wars, right? Like,
sure. I mean, I think, seeing one of the original films in the theater made a big difference.
And I saw them in the theaters. Yeah.
And I saw none of them in the theater.
I saw Return of the Jedi in the theater when I was like 4, and I got scared by Jabba the Hutt and had to leave, but that did not deter me.
I mean,
my first film in theaters was E.T., and I got scared.
Oh, God, that movie freaked me out. Oh, my God, the same. I was like, why is this horror movie on the screen?
Yeah. In fact, for years after that, this is like a quick anecdote that's ridiculous, but for years years after that, whenever I would drink from a mug, my reflection in the bottom of the mug, because of the way the shadow was cast, made my head look the shape of E.T., and I would freak out. And I would no mug do it. That's how badly E.T.
is. So much the same. Yeah. I did not find E.T. cute. I found him terrifying. The whole thing with him being like, medically whatever by the guys in the tents and everything, it just freaked me out. Oh, God. I was like, what is this?
I couldn't watch it again for ages.
Yeah. I totally am the same. I'm totally with you. And then the Atari game, don't get me started. No. But
okay, let's get into it. I want to hear stories, critique. Yeah. Because I feel like he liked it the least of all of us. So I want to hear
probably.
His.
I mean, so it's tough, right? Because I did like it. The more I have thought about it, the less I have liked it. But like,
How I felt about Last Jedi. That's so funny.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's not a very good movie, right? It's just not a very good movie, but I enjoyed watching it. And so that it's fine. It's just fine. Like, my conclusion was, it's like an above average Star Wars film. Like, there were a lot of things, not that I was like looking forward to hating, but that I was really afraid they were going to do. And they did all of them a little bit, but not as badly as I was worried. So it's like, you know, and just to clear the deck, spoilers to all to hell ahead. So like,
yes, spoilers.
I mean, enjoy the. I hope you're turning away from this from the Democratic National Convention, in May or June or whenever that is, the when you're able to listen to this. But you know, if you haven't seen the Rise of Skywalker, please go see it first.
Go see it.
Anyway, we'll wait. All right, now we're back. Like, Rey was actually of lineage, but it was Palpatine. So it's, like, a little better than it could have been. Like, she's not a Skywalker. And, you know, Rey does kill Palpatine, but it's in this, like, we ripped off Harry Potter way. And so, like, I mean, probably my biggest objective critique is, like, they just cold ripped off Harry Potter everywhere they could. I'm just like, oh, this is just Harry Potter 7. Oh, this is from Harry Potter 7. Oh, nobody's dead. Oh, you have your parents as Force ghosts, except that it's not your actual parents who actually sacrifice themselves for you in a very Harry Potter way. But it's Luke and Leia, your, like, adopted parents who, like, but nobody dies because welcome to Nobody Dies Land. Like, 5,000 ships die and crash, but nobody dies. And if they die, they still come back. So, like, there were definitely some issues with it. But they didn't fall into the worst possible traps and pitfalls. And there were some truly, like, dramatic and interesting moments. So, you know, I enjoyed it as it was happening. It was way too frantic. It should have been a 4-hour movie if they were going to do all that.
Yeah. Well, he was trying to tell an entire trilogy in one movie.
I don't know. And, like, you know, it definitely shafted some characters and some plots that were the best parts of Last Jedi.
You stay home, Rose. We don't need you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's terrible.
I heard today, just one quick note, I heard today that the script writers, like, swore up and down that she was one of their favorites, and the reason that they had to sideline her, reduce her role, is because they wanted her together with Leia the whole time, and because of what happened, which, by the way, I think they did a brilliant job given the circumstances trying to work Carrie Fisher back into it in a way that, you know, I think it could have been so much worse. They truly tried. But anyway, so they claimed that they did this on that basis, and that was why, was because they wanted her centered with Leia all the time. And so that means there's only so many times you can put her in there because of the situation. I mean, for what it's worth, who knows? Maybe that's just
Rose invented after the death of Carrie Fisher. So, like, how does that make sense?
No, it's because they wanted, when I guess Rose had been written in as this thing where she was like a big part of connecting with Leia. I don't remember why they said thematically this was the case, but you know, so as a consequence, they were sort of limited in what they could do with her. I mean, it's entirely possible that's all bullshit, but it sounded to me like
to reiterate what we were talking about last night, Greg. Rian Johnson said that they added Rose as a plot device in The Last Jedi because they were going to do the casino adventure with Poe and Finn, and they just felt like that pairing was boring for some reason. So they made up Rose so that she could go with
God knows why they thought it was boring. But anyway. Okay, so sorry, story. Go on.
Yeah, no. So that's, I mean, so yeah, like you know, if you don't think about it very long, like, the movie is really frenetic so that you can't think about
That's very true, especially the first half hour.
And so it's like, if you are just on, like, pure adrenaline, the entire time, and you're like, and there is a lot of anticipation for this movie, right? Like, as the culmination of the entire, like, nine tuplet or whatever you call it, like, you know, series. And as Alex kept, you know, somewhat cynically saying, is like, oh yeah, this is the biggest Star Wars movie until next Christmas. You know, like, whenever episode 10 comes out, like, it's not going to have the same incubation period that Return of the Jedi did or anything. But you know, it feels like a big culmination, and it's like fast paced enough that if you don't think about anything for more than 5 seconds, you're like, oh sure, I guess that makes sense. Oh sure, I think I've seen that in 12 other movies, but okay. Oh sure, yeah. Oh sure, okay, this happened. Oh, okay, 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 okay.
Right.
And then you sort of go home and ruminate about it, and you're like, well, I guess that wasn't that great. But, like, I don't know. Yeah. I
was. You know, that's what Hitchcock called the refrigerator test, where he said you go – that was the term, and he said you see a movie in the film, a movie in the theater, and when you come home, when you're that night, when you go down to get a snack, a midnight snack,
of course,
and you're standing in front of the refrigerator, that's the moment that you go, wait a minute. Then if it passes the refrigerator test, like if you don't until that moment really question it, then it's worked, he thought, as a film, which is interesting because – you know, I think Hitchcock probably held up better than that, you know, but that was the way that he always imagined it. Anyway, that just happens to be a term that he used. So
Hitchcock making a refrigerator analogy makes no sense at all, because he famously Hitchcock, what was the story? He like ate like a 7-course meal at a restaurant, and then the waitress came by and he said, play it again, Sam, and they just did the whole thing again.
Yeah, no, I am not surprised that this centered around food and for Hitchcock, but so like I've sort of like highlighted my litany of objections. I have no interest in doing a 2-hour takedown of the like shoelace color of the, you know, the people in the, like Russ did with Last Jedi, of this movie, because I think it's like it is better than average and it's fine, and I don't think any of them, with the possible exception of Last Jedi and maybe Empire, I don't think any of the movies are like great cinema. So it's fine. Like it pressed some buttons, it closed things up. It was like the last 30 seconds were god awful and like, you know, like just so hopelessly bad. But like, you know, the 2 hours before that were like, they were fine. They were solid. You know, it's fun to learn that there's no mortality in space. That, you know, that was like the two kind of jokey subtitles I had for it were like, you know, the Bushes and the Clintons are the only families that matter, like Dynasty Forever. And in space, no one can ever die. Like, instead of no one can hear you scream.
Except for
like,
General Hux, who just got straight assassinated in the middle of the movie.
One of several characters that you're like, well, so much for him.
That was a funny moment. That was a good moment.
I really enjoyed that, because I feel like he'd become such a useless caricature that they're just like, wait, we have no... I guess we could try to make you a spy, but honestly, like, you've got to go for this to be taken.
Which was TLJ's fault. Because he actually had the potential to be a really interesting foil for Kylo after Force Awakens, and then Last Jedi's like, nope, he's a joke now. He's a mom joke. And we're like, all right, well, so much for that guy. I felt like that was one character that just got badly wasted. I mean, I thought it was funny. Like, I'm the spy. I'm like, no shit. Like, how is this not the most obvious thing of all time? Like, of course you're the spy. You know, like, whatever. Like, he was not that relevant to me, so I don't really care, but I did think it was kind of too bad. And there were a couple cases where characters got wasted, but I think a lot of that was because of the sort of tug of war happening between the films. But anyway, so how do you want to do this? Do you want to, like, have each of us give our take, and then we all chat about, like, combine them together into the smorgasbord of the Met Report take on Rise of Skywalker?
Sounds reasonable.
All right. So, what do you want to make this the continuum, Russ? Like, I don't like. I know you liked it a lot.
You loved it. Yeah. Right.
Okay. Russ? Sure. Let me say, I agree with everything that Story just said. Every single thing, I 100% agree with.
Okay.
And let me also just like roll back some of my insane critique of The Last Jedi while I'm at it, which is that.
Oh, nice.
I think the reason, because it is. 100% sure you could get very nitpicky about plot holes and weird things that happen in this movie. For instance, and this has been a well-treaded path in like Red Letter Media's critique, which came out recently, which was a really good critique. They thought it was silly, the movie. Like, for instance, the Sith dagger that's like thousands of years old. Why does it have an extension that comes out of the hilt that lines up with the crashed ship from a generation ago if this dagger is like thousands of years old. Like, that makes no sense.
Well, because they predict the future, though. I buy that.
Sure.
I mean, there's okay. all kinds of visions you can do.
Okay.
Right? I mean,
yeah, that's fine. I mean, yeah, the Force can fill a lot of potholes for sure.
I realize that the Force is the auto answer to everything. Yeah. So I realize right, yeah, that
exactly.
because Force, yeah. I get that. But
yeah, definitely. But in terms of the reason I was so nitpicky about TLJ, and it took me several years to come to terms with the reason that I felt I was so betrayed by the movie, was not because of the bad fight choreography, which was still bad,
yeah,
and not because the movie was just, the humor didn't land, which it didn't, but the real objection that I had was that you just can't make a postmodernist nihilistic Star Wars movie. You just can't do it. You can't go, what are stars? What are wars? Do those things have any meaning, really, when you think about them? And then the whole audience gets depressed and goes, you're right, there are no stars and there are no wars. What the hell have we been doing for 40
years? You know, the Force sucked. It was better when I liked it.
That's like the underlying thesis of The Last Jedi, which is like, I mean, yes, to be sure, especially from someone who's been such an ardent pacifist for his whole life, his story, like, it makes sense that he would love an anti-war theme in Star Wars. But that's not what Star Wars
Star
is.
Peace.
It's in the title of the thing is Star Wars. The assumption built in, baked into the cake, is that there are good guys and bad guys, and it's a very simplified Joseph Campbellian hero's journey of a story. And it can't just be a, like, everything is meaningless and everyone's actions are meaningless and we're all just in the cosmological soup doing random things for no reason. Like, that can't be a Star Wars movie. As you know, artfully as it was presented in The Last Jedi. So that was, I think, why it made me so angry and bored to sit through that movie. And then I went and nitpicked a bunch of things unnecessarily, which you could totally do with this movie. So I think the reason that I like this movie, and again, I gave it a 7 out of 10, and that's as a Star Wars movie. As a regular movie, it's probably less. The Star Wars scale is, you know, inflated because of the,
I agree.
The terrible I agree. Prequels. So for a Star Wars movie, it was good. For a regular movie, it was just like all the other sequels and prequels. Like, it can't stand on its own as a movie, and it requires all this plot and 40 years of history and references and nostalgia and things that you can't just watch it by itself.
Right.
Here's why I liked it. Because it was a Star Wars movie. Because it was fun. And it was actually funny. And there was an adventure that you cared about. And there were people that you were rooting for and against. And it was just, these aspects were very clearly presented. And you know what? I asked for two things to be in this movie, which is, one, I wanted more Sith mysticism is what I wanted in
sure
this movie,
that.
Which I got.
That.
I would have wanted even more, but the amount that I got was satisfactory. And I wanted Wedge Antilles, and I got that too. And so I got just everything I wanted.
It's all I wanted. Star Wars character, every single character who has ever been in a Star Wars film, except for Jar Jar Binks, was in this film. So,
and hey, they covered my base. I just wanted to see Wedge, and go, and I literally, in the theater, it was maybe a half a second that he was on screen. And nobody in the theater knew who that actor was because he's old, and he's just part of the giant fleet that Lando brought back.
I could not have told you.
I saw Wedge there. I did want to have in that whole sequence where she's lying on her back and like, which I thought was a really good scene, and all the Jedi are like, you know, we're all, and you hear all the voices of the Jedi, one being like, Misa took the, no, like, you son of the, like, you bastards, like,
that would have been
the Jar Jar Binks.
The audience score would have been cut in half.
Exactly, like, it would have gone from, like, because, you know, the way it worked was, Last Jedi had, like, 90% Rotten Tomatoes critics and, like, 48% fans, and this,
because it was a movie!
And this was opposite. This was opposite. The opposite was, here, it was, critics were, like, you know, 53%, and the audience was, like, no, go to hell, 88% or whatever. And so I could just imagine, like, Jar Jar's appearance, immediately 44%. They're just like, nope.
Exactly.
But anyway, sorry.
Babu Frick was all I needed. He was so funny,
Babu
and
Frick.
Stupid, and cute, and great. And that's what I remembered most about the movie. It was like, Babu Frick was a delight. Thank you very much, J.J. Abrams.
He gave you the whole thing, Babu Frick. That's funny. That's it? Like, that's your
I mean, look. Also, as I mentioned to you last night, there were some telltale Easter eggs potentially dropped in The Force Awakens that Rey was a Palpatine. The fact that she's named Rey, which is maybe a root of gray, meaning that she has like light and dark aspects.
Right.
Hold on one second.
This is the moment where perhaps the gray Jedi, the Force is like, no, bring toy piano, bring.
Exactly. You shall not reveal our secrets.
Wipe them out, all of them.
Yeah, I just had to execute Order 66 in my living room.
Exactly.
I'm sorry.
That's actually really dark because you have children in your house.
Oh my God, yeah. Sorry. I had to destroy the younglings. Like, everyone's like, wow.
Order 66. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So there was that. Apparently her fighting style is very similar to Palpatine with like jabbing motions. Somebody made that argument. And then there was another thing like the face grimacing. The fact that she, one of the big complaints from the critiques of the early prequels about Rey was that she would learn abilities too quickly without training. This is like the Mary Sue argument. But the one character who's always been able to adapt quickly and defeat people with more training in his history has been Palpatine. So all those things like weirdly matched up, even regardless of whether you think J.J. Abrams had to like backfill and rewrite history after The Last Jedi. But that may have been a seed that he was planting without telling anybody, and then he ended up growing it despite the next movie saying it wasn't going to happen. I agree with what you said. The first half hour of this movie was insanely frenetic because it felt like JJ had to write a whole nother movie to replace The Last Jedi.
Yep.
And then there were so many things where he was just backslapping things that happened in The Last Jedi and go, Rose, you stay home. You did come from a family. Wars matter. There are good guys. Look, there are people to help us. The rebellion's not five people left in space. Sad.
Chewbacca isn't just
no food.
Chewbacca's not just an Uber driver. He actually is a person that matters.
But he's not dead when he's definitely dead.
And he was definitely dead.
Tell you why? Hell no.
It's a different transport. You mean the thing where he's on the planet? Like that whole business? He's on a
different
transport.
There was no other transport. This is not a nitpick. This was something where it's just like a stone cold hole where it's like I am left to assume that Kylo conjured with his mind a fake transport that she then thought was the one that was on there. You never see another transport. You know, going there. So I don't know. That was just a stone cold.
Interesting. No, I never thought of it as being that big a deal. I just assumed it was another transport. But
and like, I could go and complain about the new aspects of the Force and the new Force powers that are revealed in this movie, as I did with like Leia floating through space in the previous movie. Like, I could complain about Rey being able to heal, but I don't know. It felt reasonable. What I thought the most ridiculous thing was at the end when she dies and he resurrects her.
Oh, the Romeo and Juliet moment, yeah.
Yeah, then I was like, and literally in the theater, I was like, your turn, because now it's like Rey's going to resurrect him and die.
Right.
And then he's going to have like this infinite
and then you have regression. Then you have a micro version of the entire trilogy.
Exactly.
Push me, pull you.
Yeah, no, that did not make any sense either. I thought the healing stuff was kind of cool. What was ridiculous is I remember like we had the debate about like, oh, The Last Jedi was totally over the top because Yoda maybe but probably didn't but possibly conjured the lightning storm that burned the old scrolls,
right?
Yeah.
And then
Luke pulled an X-wing out of the water.
30 minutes doing, he's like, you want to be sure that we can do things as Force ghosts? Here, I'll terraform the entire planet for you. Like, well, like, yeah.
Although that sequence is one of
ship done sailed.
That sequence is one of many things I actually like, though, the partly because one understated point about this, which I'll talk about more when I get to my section, is how much of a joy it was to hear John Williams one last time in action as a score, as the guy who did the scoring. John Williams is just so goddamn good. You could make an argument that the Star Wars films are literally half of what people imagine them to be in terms of the kind of hold they have on the American consciousness, if not for his music. And the when Luke pulls the X-Wing out and you have that echo back to what I think is the greatest moment in the entire 9 movies, which is Yoda pulling the X-Wing out of Dagobah, that the swamp, which I just think is absolutely brilliant. It nails everything right. It's right on story. It's brilliant on character. It's wonderfully acted by not just Mark Hamill, but by Frank Oz as Yoda, and by the puppeteering, which is underrated, by the way, how good the puppeteering on Yoda is. Just like absolutely brilliant. And so the music, there was an echo of that when he pulled it out. And for me, I'm like, man, I have to be honest, like as soon as basically from Chewie crying after Leia is, you know, Leia is goes and gives herself to the Force or whatever, that whole moment on, I was messed up. Like the Chewie thing messed me up a lot. I was like, this is really, it was rough. Like it was in a good way. I mean, like it was very, very emotional. So sorry, yeah, Russ.
And I thought, you know, JJ did a reasonably good job of addressing some of the complaints of fans. For instance, they thought that Rey had way too much ability and was way too close to being able to defeat Kylo with no training, and Kylo had been training his whole life. And
this humanized her. She did have some flaws in this.
Yeah. You know? So in this movie, he set up her being trained. And I thought the twist of her being trained by Leia was really interesting.
Absolutely.
To do those flashbacks of Leia completing her Jedi training, like after the fact, after the return, where they're just, you know, on Dagobah, just going back to their training, and you have Rey there meditating and learning a new skill. Like, I thought that was a necessary thing that was skipped over in the previous two movies, so I'm glad that they filled that gap.
Yep, and, agree.
I mean, you know, I don't know, that's basically all I've got. I agree, like, going back and thinking too hard about it after the fact, you're like, yeah, I don't, how did Palpatine build 10,000 Star Destroyers on the Exegol? That makes,
well, what, he didn't, what is this? The Force is like because more powerful than any man. Like,
what is this?
He just like manifests them in seconds by thinking about them.
What is this weird link now between like Sith mysticism and Imperial starships? There's no link between those two things. They
listen,
they come,
man,
from two different things.
What do you think is behind late stage capitalism if not some dark force that is driving all of the industry, all right?
I guess maybe he just had like tons of engineers on the planet who were like Sith acolytes.
They're all
sorry.
They're all like, Go ahead. No, I was just going to say, I just want to say very quickly, they all wanted to go work for nonprofits, but then they're all just walking along and they're like, no, I suddenly feel the need to make more Star Destroyers. Like all of MIT and the greatest engineering schools all just like flowed directly to the Sith at that point. So,
well, anyway. Also like this complaint I did mean to lodge earlier also, like why can no one in the universe and none of the Sith think of anything that is not just the Death Star? They're like, I've got an idea. Let's do the Death Star times 40 million, but it's just the Death Star again, and it just blown up again.
Well, you knew that he couldn't do that.
Literally,
he couldn't have another Death Star. Thing. People would have crucified him if there was another Death Star in this movie.
But it was, because the big super weapon on this ship is it destroys a planet, and we will gratuitously show you having a planet destroyed. Now, no one you saw on that planet died, of course, because no one can die in space, but you did see the planet blow up. So there's
something. I actually have an answer to that, but I'll use it because I use this when I teach A New Hope in my science fiction class. And there's actually, it's a long running thing that works with a lot of portrayals of evil in a lot of speculative work. But anyway, we'll get to that when it gets to me.
Okay.
Oh, is that me? and now me?
I think you're up.
I mean, what else? Babu Frick, Sith artifacts, I'm good. I enjoyed it. It was enjoyable. I try not to think too much about it on the way out.
I was going to say, the level of scrutiny that you gave to this, they're like, shoelaces. Some people saw them as blue. Some people saw them as pink. I saw them as pink. No one would do pink.
No, but story. But story. Babu Frick. But story. Babu Frick.
But Babu Frick is funny.
Yeah.
And your mom jokes from Poe are not funny. And that's really my critique of the two previous movies.
Well, what's funny about that, though, is that Abrams is also about the same age as Rian Johnson, isn't he? So, because if I had to guess, I would estimate that Rian Johnson identifies himself very clearly as a millennial. And I don't know whether J.J. Abrams would put himself in that category or not.
If I had to guess, I mean, we know that J.J. Abrams is like the biggest fanboy of all time. And that's part of the reason they picked him for this.
Rian Johnson was born in 1973.
Okay.
Really?
Like,
interesting.
Like J.J. Abrams is like Spielberg reincarnate and a fanboy of these, and he just wants to recreate these things. I think Rian Johnson though he is of the generation that should revere Star Wars, I don't think he's a Star Wars fan.
Oh, I don't think he's a Star Wars fan at all. I
think he hates Star Wars, and his objective in making the movie was, I've read every possible like fan theory and commentary, and I'm going to do the one thing that nobody predicted in every case, and that's like the only guiding force behind him writing it the way that he was. He was just like, she's nothing, and it's nothing, and everything, they're just going to drive around running out of gas for 2 hours.
Screw you, Snoke. Yeah, I have to say that I agree that I don't think he's in the least a Star Wars fan, but he's actually said about his own movies, Rian Johnson, that he, you know, has famously said that he doesn't want people, he's much happier with movies being incredibly controversial. Like, he doesn't like movies that everybody
Yeah, likes, I mean, it, just he, it was very intentional, fun. Yeah.
You know, so, all right. Was that, do you want to say Babu Frick again, or are you
good? I'll say Wedge Antilles one more time. That makes me happy.
But. All right, good. All you needed was, now, if Wedge Antilles had Babu Frick on his shoulder, I think you would have felt, right?
You know what? And everyone would have hated this, and there's no way they would have done it, but if they could have had, like, Force Ghost Luke, like, pop into Wedge's ship for a moment and just be like, Wedge, you got someone on your six, and he like helps him out in the way that Wedge helped him out in A New Hope.
And Babu Frick points out the Force Ghost to Wedge and is like, hey.
Oh, God, if Babu Frick could be driving a tiny X-Wing around, it would make my day. That's all
so
I want.
Funny. All right, yeah, well, I'm done. So this is actually one of those situations where we often joke that, like, I'm somewhat in the middle of these things. I don't know. I actually may have liked it even a little bit more than you did, Russ, although I think I liked it a lot also. I definitely think that there are definitely issues with the movie. I would agree that it's certainly not brilliant cinema. I think it's better than the prequels, but it's not hard to be better than garbage. So I think that's fine. You know, Phantom Menace had Liam Neeson, Ewan McGregor, and a great lightsaber fight. And that's pretty much all. And you know, John Williams music. The Attack of the Clones is an absolute disaster in every respect and is, you know, good Lord. And Revenge of the Sith is okay and is the only movie that should have been made of the prequels. Like, honestly, if you're going to make one, you should just made it Revenge of the Sith, which is, again, still not brilliant, but it's okay. So comparing these to that is not, you know, it's not a very big bar to clear or high bar to clear. I think a lot of the issues that came up with Rise of Skywalker came up as a consequence of things that The Last Jedi just blew up or threw away. And the biggest thing for me, and the thing that Russ and I were talking about last night, is that you cannot, in a 9-part story, undercut the mission of the message of the story in part 8. Like, you can't say, all right, I'm going to subvert expectations now. Like, you can't do that. You're part of a collaborative storytelling arc. To me, this is very much like if you had the Lord of the Rings films, and then in the Two Towers, we get to, you know, somewhere in the middle, and all of a sudden Sam is like, because I too am Sauron. And it turns out that Sam is actually Sauron and that the ring is actually a good artifact and that he's been trying to get them to destroy it so that he can take over the earth. I mean, like, that would have been the same level of, to me, just dismissal of an entire line of working before this. I think there are many places where you can subvert expectations, you can go in a new direction. And I think if you're going to do that, at the very least, you need to bring him in movie 7, not in movie 8. And I think the person who really deserves to be fired for all this is Kathleen Kennedy, because I think Kathleen Kennedy basically said, let me get two directors who utterly disagree about what Star Wars is. Let me bring them in together and then tell them, go nuts, and literally tell them you can do whatever you want. And then watch as this bizarre volleyball match of, here, let me set up all these things, Rian Johnson. Let me kill all of those things off, J.J. Abrams. Let me kill off what you killed off and resurrect the people that you killed off that I really wanted in the first place. You know, like this, it felt very much like this bizarre tennis match among films between directors. And Kathleen Kennedy is 100% responsible for that. She should never have allowed that kind of disconnect to me to happen. So I think that a lot of the problems I had with Rise of Skywalker that I did have came about as a consequence of trying to compensate for Last Jedi. And, you know, so I 100% agree with that. It's way too fast and manic. Interestingly, it is absolutely not bloated. In fact, where I thought The Last Jedi basically could have taken a half hour off of its running time, Cantobite, I think you could have had in The Rise of Skywalker, you could have added a half hour easily, and it might have slowed things down a bit, because my God, there is not a lot of pacing where everyone gets to relax, especially in the first half hour of the movie, where you're just like, plot point, exposition point, beat, stop. You know, like, you're just like, what is going on? It's very rushed, because I think J.J. Abrams was like, oh my God, what do I do now? Because, like, literally, Last Jedi is like, well, there's 12 people left in the Resistance. Nothing you ever thought mattered about Star Wars matters. Yeah. So have fun.
But wait, there's a kid who can make a broomstick hover.
Right, Broom Boy. So now in movie 9, we'll talk about Broom Boy. Like, I mean, what? So I think that J.J. Abrams was like, basically panicked about how do I bring all this together. So the movie then comes off as manic, especially in its first half hour. And there are definitely, you know, aspects of the plot where you're like, what? Like, you know, things that happen. The whole, like, MacGuffin, we need to go find the Sith thing to go do the other thing, which is basically just an excuse to get Poe and Finn and Rey hanging out together, which is what people wanted them to be doing from the beginning, instead of having them split up and go off on these side quests. That, I think, is, you know, didn't necessarily, I understand why they did, and it was fun to watch, but from a story point of view, it didn't always work well. I don't understand why, you know, you have all of a sudden these things that happen that they seem as to think of as these incredible discoveries, like the stormtroopers fly now. I'm like, yeah, they're jet packs. You've seen you've seen stormtroopers fly on multiple occasions. Why is this a revelation? So there's things like that I think, you know, they sort of did just for the sake of it. And so, you know, again, it's not perfect. And I don't know if I love the Palpatine stuff, because it did feel to me as if it's like, we got to reach all the way back to get to another hero, to another villain that seems suitably epic. But part of the reason that happened is because Rian Johnson decided to kill off Snoke in movie 8 with, you know, in an ignominious and then everyone's dead type of mode. So
at
I don't
least
know.
Someone died.
Yeah, but somebody died. Let's set him up as
at
being
least mortality. It's part of space.
Even more powerful than Palpatine, but let's kill him off with a lightsaber from his very unstable apprentice. I completely buy that. Yeah.
Other amusing things about the movie, the fact that was it either Merry or Pippin, speaking of Lord of the Rings, who showed up for 5 seconds for no reason.
Yeah, Dominic Monaghan's character. Yeah, exactly. And I guess there was a, not David Tennant, Matt Smith, right? The Doctor Who. There was some, like, deleted scene that mm-hmm. he was in also. And
yeah, and then anyway. Carrie Russell having, like, a relatively meaningless role as the love interest of Poe, who was that other, like, bounty hunter.
Yeah. Yeah, that was that whole sequence, which is basically just Disney being like, don't think that Poe and Finn are into each other, okay? They're not gay. Even though Oscar Isaacs was very much like, hey, I think it would have been great. That's totally what we should have had.
But I think that whole thing was just J.J. Abrams getting all of his lost buddies, like, paychecks in the last Star Wars opportunity.
Charlie and Lost, who has never been in anything else in his entire life. I was like, oh, that's Charlie from Lost. Like,
yeah. No,
JJ's like, you get a beach house.
It's so true. So I think those things are there. Having said that, though, this got me emotionally in a way that Last Jedi didn't get at all. I didn't feel moved by anything in Last Jedi, and I felt extremely moved on multiple occasions in this movie, especially in the second half. I thought just in terms of cinematography, I thought this film was brilliant. I think the lightsaber fight on the destroyed Death Star is an utterly brilliant set piece. First of all, it's an actual lightsaber battle, which Last Jedi seem to forget exists. It was an actual lightsaber fight with, like, really good fighting choreography done from both of them, with emotional stakes, with things that matter. It keeps Rey from being a Mary Sue. The Leia stuff reaching out to Kylo at that moment.
Oh my God, Han showing up? That got everybody.
That was really great. But I thought the Leia sequence of mm-hmm. basically holding her son back was brilliant too. And that was totally viable. And that's been set up on multiple occasions. That was not a sort of deus ex machina thing. She has often been able to reach across to Luke and to other people that she had connected
with. And point of fact, that was actually a point of consistency with Last Jedi, which is like Leia died by using her force to project herself outward, which is the same way.
Which is what happened with Luke. That's true. Jedi, yeah. That's true. And I think in general too, that I also want to say from a character point of view, I always liked Daisy Ridley. I was not as down on her as some people were. But I think I think that Ray was absolutely a Mary Sue up until this movie, where I think they made a big effort to humanize her, to give her actual flaws, to demonstrate the possibility of being seduced by the dark side. I thought they did all of that very, very well. And I thought it was interesting that Kylo becomes the character who connected with her. And I liked the Force Dyad idea, sort of is one of the things that kind of brings her forward in that journey.
Yeah, I was totally fine with them being able to like teleport objects between the two of them because they have this special relationship.
It was neat because it is not something which is shown quite a bit, but it does explain a lot of the other stuff that happened. And the other thing is, just from an acting point of view, I think Adam Driver really grew on me. You know, I didn't love him as Kylo in Force Awakens, but I have to say he did a really good job creating actual complexity in this villain and making him someone that you could, I really bought his arc, you know, about the way that sort of things came together. And that moment with Han showing up, where he is basically, it is a memory, and it's basically him saying the same things that he said before, except this time Kylo does what he should have done from the beginning and throws the lightsaber away. And I thought all of that was really, really well done cinematographically. I already talked about how the Chewbacca stuff messed me up. Like that when the stuff happened with Leia, which I thought was beautifully handled, I was like, oh my God, I had a really hard time emotionally with that, because it was just, you really felt it. And that was something that I think for me, The Last Jedi for me missed the heart, and this had heart. I think it's sloppy at times. I agree that there's fan service and nostalgia, but I also read a really interesting article in Forbes, I think it was by Eric Kane, who sort of challenged this idea that somehow there's something wrong with nostalgia, that somehow that is an invalid device from a storytelling point of view. And the answer is, it's not, right? Like, it is a perfectly valid device. It's not the device that you want for everything. And this is why I kind of wish they had just given Rian Johnson his own new 3 set of movies without him being involved in this at all. Like, have him go off and do his own postmodernist whatever with Star Wars, and that's 100%. Fine. But don't
make
him
an existentialist French. Absolutely. I mean, like, Rogue One was kind of like that. Rogue One was everybody dies.
Sure.
Everybody dies.
Yeah.
There's no hope. It's just like, you know, adventure with peripheral characters that'll never persist, and he could do whatever the hell he wanted. And a lot of people, including me, loved Rogue One.
And I, you know, and like, those are people that, and like, some people will like or dislike or whatever, but they would see it as being valid and consistent. Instead, they just shoehorn him into the middle of a movie, and they're like, here is this movie where people have reverence for this. And he's like, I don't like movies with reverence. Let me undercut everything. And then you're left with J.J. Abrams trying to rip it back to reverence. And, you know, Abrams, I think, is a good filmmaker, but I don't think he's like amazingly like brilliant in every respect. And I think he does have a tendency to fall back on, you know, asking everyone almost sort of like, is this okay? Are you having fun now? This was fan service. Is that okay? So he does have a sort of a tendency, I think, sometimes to be a little too cautious. But I don't necessarily think that because a movie ending a 40-year arc looks back to the previous 39 years, that makes this movie invalid. And so I came out of the movie sort of, I cried through a lot of the second half of the movie. I felt it was really, really beautiful sort of emotional storytelling, even if intellectually aspects of it didn't kind of all fit together. And I think one of the things about Evil that I want to say, there are 3 things about the movie that struck me as being subtle that people missed, that to me summed up why this movie was a lot better for me than Last Jedi was, and why I think of the 3, it's the best of the 3 of the new ones, which still doesn't make it better than, you know, other things, but other than the prequels, but still. The first is that there's 2 lovely moments, and then I want to answer Story's point about the everything is a super weapon. So the first thing is, there's a lovely moment after everything's over, basically, and Rey goes back to Luke's home, and Rey is standing outside his home, and she gets onto this little piece of armor plating and basically sleds down the sand into Luke's house. It was a really subtle, quiet, gentle, and I thought lovely moment. It was played up almost for playfulness. It's a callback to her upbringing on a desert planet. It's this sense of her still being kind of young in a lot of ways, and not just, I'm now an aged, you know, ancient sage like Luke was. It's hardly a big deal, but it's, if we're going to nitpick other things, I think that's an example of a good subtle moment that not every director would think to do. And so I give them credit. And if it was the second unit director came up with that, then good job by her. But I really thought that that was a nice little lovely moment when Ray does that sort of surfing down in the sand type of thing. The second thing is that I love the fact that in that closing sequence with Palpatine, that she actually does not kill Palpatine. It may indeed be ripping off Harry Potter. I hadn't thought about that. For them, I guess that's true.
Also, arguably ripping off Infinity Endgame because of like the working in all of your friends at the end of the movie.
Yeah, I haven't seen Endgame. I don't know, but I mean, I'm sure that that could well be the case. But the thing I liked about that was, so Palpatine gives her this Sophie's choice, right? And he says, okay, so you can strike me down, and then you will become the most powerful, you know, you can then take over the fleet and save your friends. But then I live in you, and then you are the Sith, right? And that's the vision she had where she was fighting Swiss Army lightsaber person.
Can I add really quickly that it like makes sense now in Return of the Jedi that Palpatine seemed to sincerely offer to Luke the opportunity to strike him down. And it was like, at the time, we all thought he was bluffing and that he was just trying to stoke Luke's fury, but it turns out that striking Palpatine down is part of like the Sith path, and that's what Palpatine wanted because his spirit would have lived on in the Sith.
Absolutely. Well, it's all mirrored anyway, right? I mean, like Kenobi says, strike me down and I'll become more powerful than you could possibly imagine. I mean, that works in reverse too, right? Like, essentially, I felt like there was a lot of almost Highlander in that, right? Like that all of these things get brought together into this one force. But so the Sophie's choice is, you strike me down, take over the fleet, and then, you know, blah, right? That's choice one. Choice two is, don't strike me down, but then your friends are all going to die, and I'll kill you anyway, because you can't destroy me unless, you know, you have my power, right? Which is the classic fight fire with fire type of thing. And then there is, and I always think in those Sophie's choices that there's almost always a third alternative. And it's one that the evil force either never sees or is unwilling to acknowledge because they don't want you to see that there's a third possibility. But Rey actually chooses the third choice, which is she takes this lightsaber, combines it with Anakin's lightsaber, right? Which is an important thing, which was in the one classic JJ really yelling at Last Jedi when the Force Ghost catches the lightsaber and says, a Jedi's weapon should be treated with more respect, which is very clearly a don't ever throw my lightsaber into the water again, you clown, which is the beginning of, you know, Last Jedi. But anyway, so she uses these two lightsabers, walks forward, and reflects Palpatine's overpower, evilly sort of his belief that he can just overwhelm you with force upon himself. And just as happens in the prequels, where he ends up looking as bad as he does because Mace Windu reflects the force lightning back at him, this is his own anger and rage and evil that consumes himself. And I thought symbolically, that decision not to either choose to strike him down and become him or to turn away, and literally that's beat for beat Return of Jedi. He even opens up the window so she can see the fleet destroying her friends just as he does in Return of the Jedi. So it's very much going along the same line. But the fact that she chooses the third alternative, which is exactly what Luke does. Luke does not, in that case, strike down Vader, right? And he doesn't go after the Emperor ultimately. Instead, he throws the lightsaber away and says, you failed because I turned away from this hatred. She, in a way, does sort of the same thing, except that she actively steps towards him, resisting, like the resistance, by feeding back his anger and evil upon itself. And I thought that was really well handled and leads me to the last point about the Death Star, because that is, I think, something which evil perpetually misses. Evil always views the power in one particular axis. It views a power as being something which you wield. And those which have more power, those which possess more strength, more might, more, you know, cruelty, which makes them more mighty, those are the ones who will succeed and the other ones will pass. That is the will of what the Sith says. Tap into your emotions so that you can become more powerful. What evil always misses is that there are aspects of good that represent their own power and authority, but they don't represent it along the same axis. So in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Aslan is lying after having been killed upon the stone table. The creatures that release him from the stone table, that nibble the ropes that bound him to the stone table, are the mice, who themselves are insignificant and unimportant and who cares. In the Lord of the Rings, the last one that Sauron has got to be thinking, I promise you, on the spreadsheet of who do I have to worry about, hobbits are about 750,000 on the list. Okay, like they do not enter his consciousness. He's worried about Aragorn, he's worried about the elves, he's worried about Gandalf and the Valar, but he is 100% not worried about freaking Frodo Baggins. Okay, like he does not care about him in the least. And it is precisely because of the resilience of these creatures that have lived in the shadows, that have lived off the sort of beaten track for so long, that evil falls because they do not anticipate that those they do not view as being powerful could be. That's exactly what happens in Star Wars. You see it in A New Hope when there's this little thing, this little sort of shaft that, you know, is unshielded. Why do they not care about it? Why does Tarkin tell the guy who runs to say, we've analyzed their attack pattern and there is a danger. Shall we get to your ship? And he's like, are you, you know, at our moment of our greatest triumph? I think you overestimate their chances. His arrogance comes from evil's constant arrogance, which is the same thing that makes them want to be evil in this way, is this desire for scope, for scale, for might and power along very simplistic axes. Evil is very simplistic. It can have very big scale, but it really comes down to a selfish desire to have more than the other. And so this is writ large. So I think that the obsession with the super weapon type stuff from the Sith comes from the fact that at a certain point, for all of their mysticism and all of their cunning qualities, ultimately they believe in power as existing in one way. So the idea that you would actually have someone who would not choose to join you or choose to strike you down, but instead reflects your evil upon yourself, the idea that these big super weapons, which are incredibly inefficient and allow things like small, tiny, nothing ships to show up out of nowhere. When the fleet shows up, remember at the end of Rise of Skywalker, you know, the First Order people say, what is that? That's not, that this is not a fleet. And they're like, that's not a fleet. That's just people. Because the fleet is just a bunch of all these different ships, like combined from everywhere. Like, oh my God. What are these ships? I think that to me reflects a beautiful example of the constant failure of vision that evil perpetually possesses, its inability to understand that scope and scale is not all that creates power. And so I think in a way, that arrogance, bringing it low, is very much in line with the ancient Greeks, with the Romans, with classic storytelling. So I think that's the argument why. Now, I agree that having said that, there is a budget to consider, and the fact that they apparently have no problem just constantly losing star base killer weapons that cost 6 quadrillion credits, and it's like no big deal. Like that's just a disruption in the budget for like 3 seconds. I agree that that's hugely problematic, but I think that you can make a good argument that it's literally an aspect of their personality which contributes to them. And remember, the Greeks said, character is destiny. What you are defines what will happen to you. And in a lot of ways, Palpatine's character does represent his destiny. So I think Rise of Skywalker works for me on so many levels in that regard. Again, it's sloppy. There are serious issues here and there. I you know, the fact that how does Lando and Chewie even get to that many galaxies that quickly to get that much of an arm? Like, what about the time? And so definitely there's aspects of it that are problematic. But I felt moved by this movie in a way that I did not feel moved at all by The Last Jedi, and felt somewhat in Force Awakens, but not nearly as much. And so I think that's powerful. And I think that's what people are responding to. And I have to say, as a critic myself, as a theater critic, I get a little tired of critics constantly dismissing audience reaction. At base, all of us as writers, and Story, I think, will agree with me on this, we are trying to communicate to other people. So yes, we're not trying to do focus groups about how to make people like our stuff, but we also can't just write something and say, okay, we write something which only has value for us only, and that's it, and then expect other people to go and publish it and read it. We try to write something that matters to us, but communicate it in a way that other people can, even if they don't feel exactly what we feel, they know that we felt something, and therefore they empathize with what we're writing about in some way.
I feel like
Rise of Skywalker in general, and that's my take. So
can I say really quickly, I think the reason that you're seeing this larger disparity between the audience reaction and the critics' reaction is because the critics are loaded philosophically in a particular direction. And so unless you pay off the built-in assumptions and philosophy of the critics, which, you know, is definitely more slanted towards this like post modernist, you know, third wave feminism, like new, these are what critics are now.
It's film school stuff, right?
Yeah. It's what they learn in film school and gender studies and, you know, the humanities that are being taught currently is what they're writing towards. So you have to push those buttons. So you can, and as has been done recently in movies that are very predictably almost shilling themselves in terms of like, we're going to just fill up the bingo card for the postmodernist third wave feminist critics by casting a certain way and having a story from a particular point of view that, you know, historically hasn't been shown, like, and those are all the best critically reviewed movies. And then in the cases where they don't work, like the new Ghostbusters movie, then we get into this huge cultural argument about why are we so ingrained to think that women can't be Ghostbusters? And the answer is we're not. We've grown up with awesome, powerful female heroes. Ghostbusters just sucked. And let me tell you why Ghostbusters sucked, because they didn't take the material seriously. Because in the original movie Ghostbusters, you had three straight men, and I don't mean cis white straight males. I mean that they believed in their own world and they took their world seriously. And then you had Venkman, who was the absurd, who was kind of not taking anything seriously, making fun, and he was the clown. And that allowed us a portal into that world where we believe in ghosts, but this guy's cool and we're going to follow him. In the new Ghostbusters, everyone is Venkman. There are four Venkmans. That doesn't work. Can't do that. So it's just like, yeah, I'm a Ghostbuster, but hey, look over here, jibbity jibbity. Like, every character can't be going jibbity jibbity. Somebody has to take it seriously, or the audience never takes it seriously.
Quick note. I like
the new Ghostbusters more than the old one, but that's another argument for another day.
I have to say that doesn't surprise me. I have to say about that Ghostbusters, one last comment about the Ghostbusters thing. I have to say I didn't see the new Ghostbusters because I don't understand. The old Ghostbusters was fine. Like, I don't know where it became this brilliant example of 80s cinema. Like, I was a lot more affected by, like, you know, from popular cinema, by like Die Hard and War Games than I was Ghostbusters. And others were like, how dare you take my Ghostbusters? I'm like, was it really?
I think Ghostbusters is more about just the first 40, like, forget the special effects and the stuff. I just, the first 45 minutes are just like really crisp, awesome comedy, sci-fi writing.
I don't know. But anyway, so that's my take on it. I'm curious to see what people think, but I basically agree with story two. I just want to say, I basically agree with what story said. It's just, I think I liked what it was producing, and I thought it did a better job in storytelling than TLJ in my
opinion. I just want to respond to one thing that Greg said, because, you know, I mean, I think, I don't know. I mean, I do think that actually the more that I think about our takes on these things, like, there is a lot about, like, what you think of the existence of evil and, like, the problem of evil and where evil comes from like, you know, it has a lot to do with the response. But I will say that, like, the main reason that I consume art is emotional. The main reason I do everything in my life is about emotion.
Oh, I know that. And I didn't mean to apply otherwise, by the way.
And no. Oh, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying I have never felt less emotionally invested in a Star Wars movie than this. And I will tell you why and when.
Okay.
And that was really weird, because there were times that I felt like I felt even more emotionally dead, because I'm like, the music is telling me, and the emotional reactions of the people on the screen is telling me that I should feel something right now, and I feel nothing. And I felt that again and again and again in this movie. And it was, and I cry, I mean, you know, the average, like, I cried three times at a comedy, right? Like, I cry in movies. Like, it's arguably one of the reasons I go to movies, right? I love to cry. I cried exactly once in this movie. It was when Chewie died. Asterisk, he didn't die. And when Chewie wasn't dead, and I thought about it, and it's like, Chewie is the perfect character, is like one of the perfect three or four characters to kill off in this movie, right?
Yeah,
he has been in all of the things. As soon as that happened, I was like, and it actually, like, sort of got me more bought in and invested. I mean, I do think the showdown scene with Rey and Kylo around that was really well done and was really well acted. Both Rey and Kylo in all three films, very well acted.
Yes, I agree. They had a good connection.
So they had a great connection, and I love the telepathy, and it kept getting stronger in every movie, and that was a point of continuity between the movies, and that was great. And I thought about it, and I'm like, God, did they really kill off Chewie? And I'm like, no, that's perfect. Like, Han's already dead. Like, he brings a close to this chapter of it. There may be other Wookiees in the future, but, like, this is the right kind of character to die at the end of this, you know, in this movie. And it's a warning shot. It's one of those warning shots like Harry Potter. This is, you know, because people actually died in Harry Potter 7, you know, and stayed dead.
I'm out of here. This
but, like,
garbage.
Like that, you know, it's like Hedwig, it's like Dobby, it's the right level of character, and it's early enough, like Hedwig, that it's like, oh, this is a warning, like, we're going to lose a lot of people you care about right now. And J.J. Abrams didn't have the guts to kill a damn person. He's like, no, we're not going to lose anyone. In fact, we're going to resurrect everyone that you thought you had lost.
No character left behind. We're not even going to Force
Ghost Han because Han's not a Jedi, so he can't be a Force Ghost. So he's just going to come on back and stroll up and say, hey, son, how's it going? How about a catch? And so, like, that's, you know, I don't... but once Chewie was alive, the movie lost emotional credibility for me, because if I'm going to care or be invested in, you know, if I'm going to play in the sandbox that war has value and war has meaning, the first thing that war has more than anything, right, is sacrifice, right? Is that people are and killing and dying for something and for a cause. And I may not agree with the idea of killing for anything, but there's, you know, but I can certainly buy into the idea of dying for something, of sacrificing yourself for something. I'm all on board. Once that happened, I was like, this is losing some credibility because it's not willing to take a risk or to sacrifice anything, including a moment of my happiness, for more than 7 minutes until it's undone. And then everything that happened after that decreased my emotional investment, because even though I was curious, like, you know, I had a certain kind of emotional, I had like an adrenal emotional investment of like, oh, what are they going to do next? What are they going to do next? And so I like, I enjoyed parts of the movie, but as far as anything that would make me sad, or, you know, or really tap into the emotions that I kind of most enjoy exploring in art, it was gone, because I'm like, I don't trust you. Anyone who's dead may be back to life in 5 minutes. And then it happened over and over.
Yeah.
It's like Leia's not really gone. Luke's back. Han's back. People who you thought were dead in previous movies, who you've forgotten even were in those movies, are back. Like, Lando's back. Everybody's back.
Hey, man, alive. Akbar was never back. Perfect. All right.
Yeah.
Akbar didn't come back.
You know, yeah, fair enough. But like,
Akbar is permanent.
So right. And so I just couldn't get upset. You know, it's like I recognize that they were trying to make Leia dying an emotional moment. And I think some of this was slightly mitigated by the fact that Carrie Fisher died a long time ago. And so it's like, well, this had to happen. But then again, it's like, she's not even dead. So like, why do I care? So
I think
was the weakest point of the movie for me personally, because it just didn't, even in the moment before I got to the fridge, that just did not, that fell short for me. Whereas The Last Jedi, I was like weeping through The Last Jedi. Like, I thought, I was very moved by The Last Jedi. So,
that's interesting. Yeah, no, I think you make an excellent point. I will agree that I think the Chewbacca thing, I think, is unfortunate for me for another reason, because even though I didn't have a logical problem with it, because I really was just like, okay, he's on another transport. But I agree it would have been better for him just to stay dead. And the reason is that is an example of I was like, oh my God, Rey failed at something. Like, she actually failed.
Yeah,
like, she screwed up. Like, oh my God, she's actually a living human being who messed up somehow. Like, one of the things, because her reaction, and Daisy Ridley handles this very well, she plays this idea that this was her fault. And then why does she have this force lightning in it? The fact that she was pushed to it by Kylo, the fact that Kylo, again, such an interesting idea that Kylo pushes her because he wants to see what she's going to do. And he does it not out of some intellectual interest, but it's really like, what would you do in this situation? Because he realizes, just as Vader realizes, that he's fascinated by Luke, because if Luke can stay hopeful, maybe there is some hope for Vader. I think that's deep down what Vader's doing. And that, I thought, was really fascinating, that Kylo is the one sort of doing this with her. And so I think the fact that she really is shaken up and basically thinks like, this was completely my fault. And Finn, you know, who again is, oh God, so tragically wasted in these movies. It's so, so ridiculous.
Oh yeah. That also brings up a critique that I'm going to assess in a second.
All right. So I'll let you do that in just a second, but just one comment about Finn. I was really looking forward to the story of Finn, and to make him into a goofy side quest guy is incredibly obnoxious and is a complete waste of John Boyega, who's a good actor. But anyway, you know, the fact that Finn is connected with Rey and is basically saying, this is not your fault. And she's, I love that. I love that. And you're right that when Chewie comes back, that undercuts a little bit of the emotional force of it, because it means then that when she then goes in to face the Emperor, she's not really dealing with the demons of anything else. All of her problems are external, right? Her problems are, I have to deal with Palpatine, which, in fairness, Palpatine's a huge problem. But it's so much more interesting to have a character who, like Kylo, is also dealing with internal demons, right? And that's something which I think this movie could have handled well. So yes, and this is where I said, I do think sometimes Abrams has a tendency towards safety. And I honestly think the reason for this, you know, I got really irritated with people afterwards who were like, oh, that's because he makes garbage movies. Look, you can say whatever you like about Abrams. This guy is not a, quote, garbage filmmaker, okay? He knows what he's doing. You may dislike the kinds of things that he does, but he absolutely knows how to make film. The sequence with Rey and Kylo, where she's up in the ship and he's down on the planet, and they're fighting, was intercut brilliantly. I mean, absolutely brilliantly. So that you felt not only the telepathy, but when they destroy something and they're both destroying something on the ship, and they do that without the audience being utterly confused, because I thought it was really, really good. He knows how to make a film. I know how he made, you know, he knows how to make a film. But again, people can disagree whether they like what he does, but he absolutely can make a film. But I think the problem with him is something that I noticed with Mark Hamill, which is Mark Hamill was very critical of The Last Jedi, and then Disney basically told him to shut the hell up. And I think part of what Hamill did in stopping with The Last Jedi, the criticisms of it, was he didn't want to be he didn't want to be the guy that brought everyone low. He didn't want to be the guy that destroyed the fan base. He's a genuinely nice guy. Like, Mark Hamill is a nice guy who really cares about his role in Star Wars a lot. Like, he really feels like Luke has had this profound effect. He talks all the time about how he's really moved by how people have been so positively affected by his character. Mm-hmm. And so I think he really didn't want people to be angry at each other. And I think J.J. Abrams has got a little bit of that in him. I don't think he likes making people angry. I think Rian Johnson loves making people angry and in his films. And that's part of why he wants to create controversy. I think J.J. Abrams does not want to make people angry. And that means sometimes he goes for something too safe. And I agree with you entirely, Story. Chewie should have stayed dead.
Yeah,
totally agree. Chewie should have stayed dead. Lando should have died in Return of the Jedi because the Millennium Falcon was supposed to get consumed in the explosion of the second Death Star, but they chickened out.
But he should have done that. But I agree with you entirely about that story. Okay. It was a little too safe. But I still... Yeah. I'll tell you what, though, Chewie's moment of feeling of his anguish at Leia's passing was still messed me up. I'll just say that.
Fair enough.
Here's point on Finn, and this actually, I don't know if it supports Story's point about needing to feel more of the sacrifice or the toils of the war, being in a war. But here's the point about Finn that was brought up on a Star Wars subreddit somewhere. You can go look it up if you want to read the whole thing. So the whole point of... partially, the point of Finn's character is supposed to be that you have this stormtrooper who had a change of heart, and he abandons the stormtroopers, which means that they're not this clone army, they're not this robotic death-trooping force, that they're just, you know, especially in the generation
child
of the First
soldiers.
Order.
Yeah,
they're child soldiers, they're conscripted, they're cobbled together, and they're brainwashed. And then so once you have Finn, you can't just mindlessly slaughter stormtroopers anymore, because any one of them could potentially be another Finn.
I thought that a lot in this movie. So, while I was watching them, like, while they were talking about, like, oh, we used to be stormtroopers, let's kill 4,000 more of them.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that even it presses the point even further that for Finn himself, who slaughters innumerate amounts of stormtroopers, including presumably lots of people that he knew and grew up with in The Force Awakens, that he's just going and killing all of them when maybe one of or many of them had a seed of doubt, and maybe they could have been turned also. Maybe there could have been propaganda campaigns that you could do to make stormtroopers give up the ship.
Yep.
Rather than just mindlessly slaughtering them. So that point, maybe we didn't need such clear white hats and black hats in terms of good guys and bad guys once we established that stormtroopers could be redeemed.
And it also makes, I think, a little bit of, you know, my frustration with one of many, many frustrations with the Canto Bight sequence in The Last Jedi is Rose's constant condescension to Finn, where she's just constantly like, well, look, this is the way war actually is. And at a certain point, I can imagine turning to her and be like, you know what? I was brought when I was like 3 and conscripted into this thing to become a stormtrooper. And a lot of these people that died were my friends. I didn't want to do this. I hate that I had to do this. I haven't been like asleep on a rock somewhere. I'm sorry that, you know, like there was just always this like, you're right, Rose. Yes, that was terrible, Rose. I should have thought of that, Rose. And I'm like, is there ever any thought about like the side of people, like the fact that these stormtroopers were all conscripted and like, you know, half of them are clones and the ones are stormtroopers are taken against their will, you know? And like, I would have loved to have seen a little bit of that rather than making the stormtroopers that he kills kind of faceless enemies. So that by the end, that's the thing. Finn at the end just becomes like another dude who fights for the resistance, which becomes the rebellion because we don't know how to make a difference between resistance and rebels apparently. But he just fights for the resistance instead of being a guy who could have been conflicted as a part of it. And they started that with The Force Awakens, where he doesn't want to fight for the First Order anymore and he cares about his friends, but he's not on board. He says this many times with the resistance initially. He's like, look, I don't know if I want to do this. Then that just gets thrown away completely in The Last Jedi, and we make him into a kind of a goofball character for a lot of it and then send him off on side quests. And then in this movie, they're just like, now he's part of, he's Star Wars guy character person. And you're like, what happened to his, I just felt like his uniqueness.
There was like a question of whether he was force sensitive or not for a little while. Like, why was he picking up a lightsaber and using it in battles in The Force Awakens? Like, was that a meaningful thing? It turned out to be a nothing. There just seemed to be a lot of wasted opportunity with that character.
And that really, to me, and this is the thing that gets me, and maybe this is a good way to maybe wrap up our discussion about this, I think. This is something which always surprises me, and it shouldn't surprise me anymore. You guys are going to laugh. You hear people talk about, these people are incredibly rich, and they've been, it is amazing how people dealing with what seem to be enormously sensitive and important things drop the ball constantly on how to do it. You know, you'd think if you were given, here, have an essentially unlimited budget, here, have one of the most important, significant cult pop culture, you know, touchstone franchises of all time, you would think that doing that, they'd be like, hey guys, so we're sitting in a boardroom, and we can't screw this up. So we've got to make sure we have a unified vision. And that means we need directors who are all on the same page. And we need to look over the story. And we need to have fight sequences where stuntmen don't very obviously miss our main actors because they would have cut their heads off within filming and the main actors screwed up. Like, we can't allow that to happen, you know? And it's amazing how often that seems to happen, where you're like, you just can't screw this up, and then they do, and you're like, well, you know, how did you screw this up?
The funny thing is that A New Hope, Star Wars, which was what it originally called, when it was made, there's a great documentary about this on YouTube. It was such a cluster. It was such a clusterfuck while it was being made. Like, the studio was they were running over budget. They were running over time. The studio broke up the production team into like three separate production teams so that they could film all the scenes they needed in the last 2 weeks. And they were like, rather than give them more budget or give them more time, they just gave them a bunch of money to finish it by a time deadline. They didn't believe in it. George Lucas was like checking himself into the hospital for hypertension and stress.
Yeah.
And the first cut of the movie was horrendous, and they had to fire the editors and hire new editors and like and tell everyone at ILM that all the special effects they made were terrible and like start over. And so for a long time, it just looked like it was going to be what most people thought about the project while it was being made. There's just this like weird space movie that is meaningless. And it was only, I don't know, through a miracle or through his vision and hard work or resilience or what have you, that it became the great thing that it was. But it could have easily just been a expensive mishmash. And it's just, I think it's just easier for an expensive mishmash to occur, no matter how many good intentions are plowed into
it. I agree. I will say that, you know, John, the music helped John Williams, who has a cameo, by the way, in Rise of Skywalker, which was fun to see. John Williams was part of the success. Jim Henson, you know, the puppeteering was not just in with Yoda, but with a lot of the stuff that they did was a significant part of what happened. And that also helped it. But the other thing I want to say is that it was a cluster, you know what, and frankly, New Hope, even today, although I think it holds up well, it's certainly not any, as Story said, any brilliant example of filmmaking. I think Empire is clearly still the best of any of the movies. But having said all of that, you know, but that was the first of those movies. Like, at this point, there should be no excuse for botching things. Like, at this point, you don't have that anymore. At this point, you're being handed an unbelievable franchise now backed by Disney, for the love of God. And I don't actually...
Yeah, but I'm going to...
So much money.
I'm going to give you a theory. I'm going to give you a theory.
Okay.
I think that these things work. I think that these things that we're talking about are not coincidences. They are causal.
Okay.
The fact that Star Wars was a shoestring and wasn't supposed to work out and turned out being a cult classic that has spawned, you know, I mean, at least 12 hours of our discussion time, if nothing else. but, you know, the reason is because there's nothing to lose there, right? Like, people do good work when there is nothing to lose and they don't have laurels to rest on or expectations to battle, right? I think J.J. Abrams, and you may like some of the things he did, and I'm glad that you were emotionally moved by this in a way that I was unable to be, and blah, 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 blah. But, like, J.J. Abrams's governing principle, and I don't think it's true of everything, because, like, he was involved in Lost, and I really think Lost is good, and I think he's made other good things. But when J.J. Abrams takes over stewardship of another franchise, because wasn't he also involved in Star Trek at some point?
He was, When he
takes stewardship of another franchise, he operates primarily from fear. And I think that's why no one was allowed to die in this. And I think that, like, fear is not going to get you, you know, great cinema or great risk-taking or something that's really, you know, and that people, like, when they are fearful, they're trying to avoid screwing up. And that the number one source of screwing up is trying to avoid screwing up too hard. I think. So, like, I just think that, like, the roots of conservatism are feeling like you have a lot to lose, and rather than feeling like, wow, we have unlimited budget and we have unlimited backing, you feel like, oh my God, we have unlimited budget and backing. Anything that I screw up or make anybody upset about or anybody the least bit unhappy about is going to be my fault because I had unlimited budget, I had unlimited backing, I had a blank check. So it's not the fault of the studio, it's not the fault of anybody else because I had all the resources that anyone would kill for.
Right, right.
So then it makes you risk averse, and risk aversion is just not good.
Yeah. I agree with you on this. I mean, I said myself that's what I talked about in terms of him about being safe. You know, like he wants to be safe. I agree with you about this. And I also think, by the way, that this is to be said. Sometimes people have talked about this with game designers, that you could argue that now there have been a lot of great games, including, by the way, Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order, which I've been playing, which is awesome. And I highly recommend it. It's got a lot of really good Star Wars stuff going on. It's a good game. Anyway, but a lot of people say that the increased room and technology available has not necessarily made people better game designers, because you could argue that in the older days when they had to get stuff into a much more limited, mm-hmm. you know, palette, right, that they were much more efficient and they were just better coders.
Television were some of the greatest game mechanics ever, and that was with no resources.
Resources at all. So right. I think that there is something to be said for that. And I agree with you that that's the case. I guess the only thing that I would say in response is, because I don't think, I've heard a lot of sort of hot takes that are those like, oh, Disney ruined this. I don't think this is on Disney. I don't think this is Disney's, quote, fault. Because again, I would argue to the cows come home that they were just as obsessed with selling stuff and everything else when they first came out with these movies. So I don't think it has anything to do with that. I don't think this is Disney's fault. I guess the biggest response I would give to what you suggest, Sori, is the existence of Empire. Because Empire Strikes Back comes up as a sequel to a major movie that came out of nowhere. And that movie not only succeeds in, like, delivering on the promise of the first movie, it exceeds it. I mean, it you know, Empire Strikes Back is a legitimately, not just Star Wars, a legitimately good movie.
It's a good piece of cinema.
And so, you know, they managed to deliver that way despite the expectations and the consequences if they failed and all that. So, but I mean, having said that, I agree with you that as the money goes up and the increased mm-hmm. sort of resources go up, that there's sort of a danger zone area there that can happen, I guess. But I do think that there is, whatever it's come, whether it's from fear, whether it's because of, you know, you don't want to lose what you have or whatever, mm-hmm. there is sometimes a very dangerous kind of something that sneaks in, but it still causes people to mess things up. And I will say that this is one of the reasons why I think the Hobbit films are pretty lousy, frankly. Mm-hmm. But the Lord of the Rings films, upon which there was incredible pressure on Peter Jackson, they're not perfect. But he did that pretty well despite the pressure and despite the sort of all the people looking at him and everything else. He delivered on what he promised, and they delivered on the promise of what the books were supposed to represent. And part of that is wonderful acting, and part of it is the technology finally meeting the moment, and part of it, I think, is Jackson understanding what makes the movies matter so that he doesn't just make it about everybody shoot, you know, Legolas and Gimli and Aragorn all going off on a buddy comedy, but the fact that really the books are about Frodo and Sam trying to destroy the source of temptation rather than just, you know, big armies fighting big armies. It's not about, in fact, war is not the point. It's the opposite of, in fact, of war. War is a distraction from the real thing that matters about those books. So in those films, they were able to do it. And it was a matter of sort of, I don't know, they were, Weta was not really a thing at the time, and they made Weta into what it was. So maybe there were less expectations with that, and The Hobbit went back to being safe and fearful. But I agree with you that courageous filmmaking is good filmmaking. I would just like to see that courage kind of matched with an emotion, and not to believe that because someone hit standard beats, traditional beats, and did things in certain ways that may reflect aspects of nostalgia, that, and I'm not saying you're saying this, but others have said, that does not invalidate a film because it is closing out a long story. And so that's why I don't think undercutting and subverting expectations, literally like 7/8 through an 8-part, or, you know, whatever it is, 8/9 through a 9-part thing, the time to do this is not part 8. And arguably not even with that story. I think subverting expectations can happen elsewhere. And that's where the, you know, courage of sort of really innovative, oh my God, we've never seen this before, can take place. So, yeah, I mean, I don't go to J.J. Abrams to be like, wow, I've never seen that before. But I do go to it if I want to feel like this is someone who's not throwing out what Star Wars was and why people cared about it. And now Skywalker is done. Like, that whole sequence is done. I don't want to see more Star. We're done with that. Like, enough.
Right.
Now I want to see new stories. The Mandalorian and others are examples of how we can have plenty of things in this universe, but enough with Skywalker now. But finishing up the arc in the way they did, I left feeling pretty happy and moved by it. And I think a lot of the audience did too. And I don't think that should be thrown out or dismissed because it doesn't fit what we learned in film school.
And can I say part of the reason, without getting into a whole Mandalorian discussion, part of the reason that part of the reason I like Mandalorian so much is because it does what Star Wars spinoffs are supposed to do, which is you take elements, which is what we do in my nerdy genre improv performances, which is we take elements from the world that people remember, and we throw them together, and we make fun characters, and we find relationships with those things, and we don't overladen everything with plot. And the problem with this 3-time trilogy is that it's so overladen with plot that you can't escape it. And it's hard to just have a fun or emotional moment between two characters because there's so many things you have to fulfill and pay off at any given second that it's just cumbersome and it's too much and it needs to be over. I'm
glad that it's over. Exactly. The past is over. Kill it if you have to. Oh, no!
don't do that.
Don't do that.
Don't do that.
Well, at least something would be dead then.
I know. Well, this also dead is the time that we have for the show because we have run over. But
is it?
Or is it? Maybe we'll come back. Story, I'm telling you now.
I'm pumping more internets into the MEP report.
I'm saying right now, Story, I had better see us represented as Force Ghosts in the graphic for this episode because, man, like I
know,
there's something about that that just speaks to me. But I really enjoyed this discussion a lot, and it felt a lot less fraught than Last Jedi because in this one we all kind of liked or really liked, but at least didn't hate the movie. And we all more or less, I mean, it was funny that we were all like, yeah, Story's basically right, but here's why it's okay that this is the case. And we're so Story's like, wait, you agree with me?
Shoelaces.
Exactly. Yeah. More shoelaces. Yeah. So if you liked what we said and did and all that kind of stuff, then please join us again for this is going to be our third decade we're going into of recording the MEP report, right?
Crap.
This is
I'm
our
ready.
Third decade of recording it. And we want to thank everyone for being with us. In all seriousness, you know, just as a personal note, Story and Russ are two very dear friends of mine who are really important to me. And having a chance to record this show has been great. Sharing it with an audience has been great. And where else do I get get a chance to hang out with such smart and good and fun people in a way where I can do it now before we all become Force Ghosts. So I think it's...
Before the decade ends, I just wanted to look upon you in the audio waves, my friends, exactly. Before my mind disappears.
And so, as a consequence...
I felt way more emotion from this episode than I did in the last Rise of Skywalker.
I am curious that this happened, and Russ's voice sounded a little bit like... you were like, so that was the thing, and that's why I am now Lord of the Sith. Like, you were like ready to go into Palpatine at any moment. And so, if you like what you saw and heard from us, mostly heard, thank you all so much. Please spread the word about the Mep Report, let everyone know about it, and we will see you all in 2020. Happy New Year, and of course, may the Force be with you. Say goodbye, everybody.
And if you didn't like it, if you strike us down, we're just going to come back and
wipe them out.
He was chasing a female he knew, as he shot past, I heard him say, she can't fly, but I'm telling you, she can run the pits of a kangaroo. She can't fly, but I'm telling you, she can run the pants of a kangaroo. Well, there is a moral to this ditty, um-ba-da-da-da-da-da. Crush can sing, but he ain't pretty, um-ba-da-da-da-da-da. Duck can swim, but he can't sing, nor can the eagle on the wing. Emu can't fly, but I'm telling you, he can run the pants of a kangaroo. Well, the kookaburra laughed and he said, it's true. Um-ba-da-da-da-da-da.